Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. In 2006, beekeepers began noticing mysterious die-offs, a phenomenon later identified as colony collapse disorder. Bees are one of the most important pollinators. They're responsible for a third of our food supply and 90% of wild plants. We also have research about butterfly declines. Well, a new report finds that the entire flying insect ecosystem is on the verge of disappearing. According to a new study published by the journal PLOS One, from 1989 to 2016, the population of flying insects dropped by more than 75% in dozens of protected areas in Germany's nature reserves. One of the report's authors and one of today's guests, Professor Dave Golson, says the results show that we're on a course for ecological Armageddon. If this trend continues, our grandchildren will inherit a profoundly impoverished and different world. About 60% of birds rely on insects for food, and 80% of wild plants depend on them for pollination. So what explains this rapid decline? What does this mean for life on planet Earth, and what can be done about it? Today we're joined by Dave Golson, professor of biology at the University of Sussex, specializing in the ecology and conservation of bumblebees. He's also co-author of the report and the author of many books, including A Sting in the Tail, My Adventures with Bumblebees. Hi, Professor Golson. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. Thank you. We're also joined by Neil Williams, professor of pollination and bee biology in the Department of Entomology and Nematology at UC Davis. Hi, Professor Williams. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Good morning. Professor Williams, I want to start off with you. I saw a couple of articles about what happens to birds during horrific wildfires. And since we are finally have the fires in the North Bay over 80% contained, I just wanted to start off by asking you, how do bees and butterflies and other flying insects deal with these horrific fires? What happens?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I would say that probably those different groups of insects might be affected quite differently, and even within the bees themselves, the responses would vary quite a bit. Although I think it's tempting to suggest that these wildfires would really decimate populations, and I think they could of flying insects, if some of them. I think that the responses of bees might vary quite a bit. So many bees nest in the soil underground, and although fires are very, very hot above ground, they don't penetrate into the soil. The heat doesn't go too deep. So for species which are nesting safely below ground and who were not flying anymore, their natural life cycle as adults flying around is finished. If they had their nests underground, they might actually survive some of the fires that we've seen. The other point is that even in very intense and widespread fires, not all specific locations are as intensively burned, and so those areas can act as small islands or refugia that from which bees might be able to recolonize the burned areas on their side. And the plus side, again, trying to give people hope here, on the plus side as well would be we often see in ecosystems that are very fire prone or historically have been, that many of the plant species tend to reflush quite dramatically following fires. The release of nutrients, reduced competition for water that comes in these systems, can lead to very prolific flowering, and so bees can come back. That is not to say that they are not knocked back by the fire, and we do see many species that are knocked back. The strongest flyers, also like the bumblebees that Dr. Golson works on, can also recolonize from the edges. So I think it's important to realize that not all will be wiped out. Other species that have their life cycles above ground will be very dramatically and negatively impacted by the fires, though, and it's an important thing to be looking for in the future.
Professor Golson, can you talk about how extreme weather has affected flying insects in Europe, whether we're talking about fires or droughts or a lot of rain?
Fire would be a fine thing in the UK at the moment, to be honest. It's it's a very cold, wet autumn, and everything is soaking, so but that's not something we have to worry about. But obviously in southern Europe, just as in California, a couple of months ago there were terrible wildfires, and more broadly the weather seems to have become more variable. This seems to be a feature of climate change. Of course, the weather has always varied, and insects have dealt with that in the past. It inevitably will impact them, but they'll spring back if everything else is okay. And the problem they face these days is that they have a whole bunch of different stressors. So there's extreme weather events, there's a slowly changing climate, massive habitat loss, and other human-made problems like pesticide use. And it's the combination of all these things that are really stressing our insects, and it's very hard for them to cope with a whole bunch of different pressures all at the same time.
How do you expect flying insects to adapt, or can you talk about how they will adapt to what's to come? Because we've been talking over the last couple of weeks, Professor Golson, about the horrific fires in Northern California, and Portugal has had horrific fires. In recent days, the death toll rose to 44. That is since Friday. The number of people who are injured is about 70. Here in California, so many scientists say that this is our new norm. Is that the case in Europe?
I honestly don't know. I'm not an expert on European forest fires, I'm afraid. And the degree to which that... I mean, a lot of these ecosystems have naturally had fires in the past. Maybe the frequency and intensity of them is greater because of things that people have done, and perhaps also because of a changing climate. We've seen climate starting to impact in other ways on insects. There was a study published a couple of years ago now which suggested that the southern edges of the ranges of some of our bees are starting to shift northwards as it becomes too hot for them in southern Europe and also in North America. The impact of fire frequency really hasn't been studied, to my knowledge, on bees and other flying insects. Mm. So we don't know that much about it.
Professor Williams, we've done a lot of shows about why bees are so important. Again, they're responsible for a third of our food supply, 90% of wild plants. We've also done a few shows about butterflies. But more generally, can you talk just about why the flying insect population is so important?
I can try. I'm not, again, an expert in all aspects of what flying insects do for us, but in particular, I would say among their most important roles that people are most familiar with is indeed pollination. That pollination is particularly important in areas where the crop production is highly reliant on insect pollination, and that would be very true of California as a whole, the Central Valley, the coastal areas, and far in the south where fruit production, both of tree fruits and of row crops, is highly dependent on a combination of managed pollinators, but also on the diversity of wild species that are out there. And I think one of the concerns that we have, which is parallel that in European countries, is this loss of habitat that supplies important resources for both the wild bees and the managed bees, and it's a problem overall. The other sorts of things of flying insects, of course, you mentioned in your introduction, supplying food. I would also note that there are many other services, in addition to pollination of wild plants and crops, that other flying insects provide, and they regulate the populations of insect pests, both in agriculture, and control the population dynamics of outbreaks in forest insects, etc. So they play a very, very wide range of services that we see across ecosystems, both the managed and the more natural systems that we have.
Professor Golson, what would you add to that? Why are flying insects so important?
Well, as Neil says, they're integral to almost all ecological communities because they make up the majority of species on Earth. I think the introduction mentioned roughly two-thirds of all species we know of are insects of one type or another. So they pollinate, they regulate pests, as we've heard. They help to recycle dung, for example, dung beetles and flies and so on. They're food for almost everything. So the majority of bird species, most lizards, most frogs and other amphibians, freshwater fish, they all feed on insects. So if we were to lose the insects, essentially the life as we know it would be utterly changed. We would also lose most bird species, most flower species. More than 80% of all plant species on Earth need pollinating. Flowers evolved to attract insects. If the insects weren't there, those plants wouldn't certainly seed. So we'd have a landscape without flowers. It's hard to exaggerate just how important insects are to life.
Professor Golson, you are co-author of the new report that came out, and it's based on the work of dozens of entomologists across Germany who used very strict standardized ways of collecting insects starting in 1989. And it found that since then, the population of flying insects dropped by more than 75% in dozens of protected areas in Germany's nature reserves. So many people were shocked by this. It's still getting a lot of attention. What was your reaction when you read the findings?
Yeah, well, I was involved in analyzing the data, and you know, when I first saw the pattern, I was kind of dumbfounded, because we knew insects were declining. We know wildlife is declining on a global scale, but we didn't know how bad it was. These data are the most dramatic I've seen. And to start with, I thought there must be some kind of error. You know, something was wrong. That someone had made some kind of mistake, and the calculations couldn't be right. But they stand up to scrutiny. We went through them with a fine-tooth comb, and it seems to be real. Of course, we can't say with certainty that exactly the same pattern is happening in other countries, but I suspect that it is. It tallies with the evidence we have for things like butterflies, which we know are rapidly declining, and the way the German landscape is managed is pretty similar to most of Western Europe, and actually quite a lot of North America too. The way we farm, the crops we grow, the pesticides that are used and so on are all very similar. So I guess it's real, and if it is real, we should be panicking that, you know, this threatens our future. And I hope people will finally start looking after the environment seriously, because I don't think the majority of people actually really consider it a priority, but it should be our number one priority. Mm.
Insects were collected at 63 locations in Germany: grasslands, swamps, sand dunes, wastelands, shrubland, and all of these locations were protected areas?
Yeah, absolutely. They're nature reserves, mostly quite small nature reserves.
Professor Williams, what was your reaction when you learned about this study?
I would agree that I was similarly stunned by reading it, and I haven't had the opportunity to go over it with the outside fine-tooth comb, but the authors that are on this paper are all, these are excellent scholars who have long histories of doing this sort of work, and I think that adds a lot of weight to this information. So what it really makes me wonder too is, although it's done at a broad scale within one country, and as Dave says, that it's likely to be representative of things that that are true across Europe and parts of, particularly in the eastern North America, it does really make one wish we had comprehensive data sets over a long time in other biogeographic areas to see whether this is widespread even beyond Europe. And I think, unfortunately, our tendency in America is to say, well, that's something that's going on there, and we will ignore that it's whatever the thing that's happening is, unless we have really good information here. Perhaps we ignore it anyway. But I would really like to see this mirrored here to add even more weight to the findings. So.
Neil Williams is professor of pollination and bee biology in the Department of Entomology and Nematology at UC Davis. We're also joined by Dave Golson, professor of biology at the University of Sussex, where he specializes in the ecology and conservation of bumblebees. Professor Golson is the author of many books, including A Sting in the Tail, My Adventures with Bumblebees. He's also co-author of this new report that has found that the flying insect population in nature reserves across Germany has plummeted by 75% over the past 25 years. Insects make up about two-thirds of all life on Earth. So this finding is very important. If you have any questions or comments about this, I know that so many of you care about insects whenever we do shows about bees and butterflies. We have so many phone calls. So if you'd like to ask our guests questions about this latest study, what it means, why this happened, what we need to do about it, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Leave us a tweet at Your Call Radio, or you can comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Professor Golson, you and your colleagues say that this study has broad implications for all landscapes dominated by agriculture. So can we assume that this has widespread effects beyond Europe?
It's kind of speculation. We don't know for sure, but my best guess is that something similar is happening throughout, certainly the developed world, and increasingly in developing countries where their kind of farming system is shifting towards mirroring ours. As Neil was saying, you know, we don't know for certain that the same pattern would have been found if someone had put these traps up in California or Pennsylvania or whatever in the 1980s. It's a real shame that we don't have more monitoring of how our insect populations are going. We only really have good schemes for butterflies in the insect world. And they are in trouble. In the UK, for example, we've seen butterfly populations, particularly farmland butterflies, falling rapidly for the last 40 years. And they're now at about half the level they were, which is a pretty dramatic and depressing decline, not quite as dramatic as this 75% figure. Famously in North America, of course, monarch butterflies are in freefall, and I don't know off the top of my head the percentage decline, but I know it's a very large figure and really saddening. So all I can say is my guess is if it's not exactly 75%, you're certainly going to be losing your insects just as we are over this side of the Atlantic. And, we desperately need to reverse this pattern. More broadly, the picture, as I see it, is that we're essentially pretty rapidly wiping out life on Earth. There have been some plausible predictions from scientists that by the end of this century, we may have lost two-thirds of all species on the planet, not just insects, but everything. And I think that's terrifying and something that, you know, everyone should be jumping up and down about, trying to do something about, instead of something that's sort of, you know, rarely actually discussed by politicians, by people who are in a position to really make a difference.
Professor Golson, talk a little bit about why this is happening. When we first learned about the bee population decline here in the U.S., in the early days, there was a lot of talk about pesticides, but we didn't have the science. And now we have so much more research about the links between neonicotinoids and the bee population decline. Can you talk about what you all looked at and what is causing this?
Yeah, we've developed a system of farming which is very, very heavily dependent on pesticides. We have these huge monocultures of crops. We keep them free of weeds by spraying selective herbicides. They're sprayed with fungicides. They're usually sprayed several times with insecticides. We've created a landscape that is essentially kind of hostile to other forms of life. A lot of the attention has become focused on neonicotinoids in particular. The reason for that is that they have a number of properties which make them perhaps more dangerous to bees than other insecticides. They're very, very toxic at minuscule doses. It takes a few billionths of a gram to kill a honeybee. They're quite persistent in the environment. They stay in soil for years, so they can accumulate if they're being used over and over again. They're systemic, so once they get into a plant, they spread throughout it, including going into the nectar and the pollen. So if it's a flowering crop, then it's being pollinated by bees, they'll get a dose of these neurotoxins. But they're also getting into wildflowers growing in non-farmed areas near farmland, which means that even if the bee doesn't visit the crop, it's still getting a dose. And these pesticides, they either kill the insect, or at lower doses, they impair their ability to navigate and learn. They suppress their immune system and so on. So I think the evidence is abundant and clear that these insecticides are contributing to bee declines. But I say that carefully, because I think some people believe that they're the sole cause of bee problems, and that if we just ban one type of insecticide, the world will suddenly be fine again. And it's a much more complicated picture than that. The wholesale habitat loss, lack of flowers, has also undoubtedly played a major role in driving bee declines.
Professor Williams, you helped design a study looking at the decline of bees in the United States, and you all found that wild bees decline where crop pollination is most needed. Can you tell us about what the latest research says?
Yeah, so that's right. This study that you're referring to, of course, was an all modeling study, so it wasn't, I think, concluding that this has happened definitively, but the evidence points to, based on changing habitat availability, that the areas where we most rely on pollination from the human side of things for crop production, not for the other services that they provide to the sustaining of natural systems, but in these cropped areas, those are the very areas where the habitat is, as Dave said, is becoming most hostile, and so we have reason to strongly suspect that we should see declines of bees in those areas. What I think is particularly concerning, too, with some of the work with real concern about the impacts of some pesticides, is, again, they are multifaceted, and the declines result not only from those factors, but some of the more recent work, particularly for me, showing that those pesticides make their way into wildflowers that are not the crop themselves, are troubling, because they limit some of the very things that we're most trying to do as a community of practice, both the growers, the conservation organizations, and researchers are looking to the diversification or the re-wildflowering of parts of the agricultural landscape, ways to mitigate the impacts of pesticides, which are part of our management system that we've designed for agriculture. And if those two become not the safe refuges that we hope, then our options become increasingly limited, and it presents an even more profound challenge. And I think we'll have to work as a group. I mean, it's very, very tricky. We have growers who profoundly rely on bees, beekeepers whose livelihood relies on managed honeybees. They all care deeply about bees and pollination, but are challenged by what they can do. How we need to become clever about how to manage the system differently so that it can sustain production, but with a very keen eye towards the sustainability of the larger system that is being degraded by the practices that we use.
Neil Williams is professor of pollination and bee biology in the Department of Entomology and Nematology at UC Davis, and Dave Golson is professor of biology at the University of Sussex and co-author of a new report that has found the flying insect population in nature reserves across Germany has plummeted by 75% over the past 25 years. Researchers say this has broad implications for all landscapes dominated by agriculture. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about flying insects as part of our One Planet series. We're joined by Neil Williams, professor of pollination and bee biology in the Department of Entomology and Nematology at UC Davis. Dave Golson is professor of biology at the University of Sussex, specializing in the ecology and conservation of bumblebees. He is the author of many books, including A Sting in the Tail, My Adventures with Bumblebees. Professor Golson is co-author of a new report that has found that the flying insect population in nature reserves across Germany has plummeted by 75% over the past 25 years. If you have any questions or comments about flying insects, the decline of bees, the decline of butterflies, what this means for planet Earth, why aren't we spending more time talking about this, and what can we do about it? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.com. Let's hear from Phil in New Mexico. Hi, Phil. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me. My question is for the professors about the 75% decline. Is that a 75% decline in species diversity, or is that a 75% decline in total biomass of the flying insect population? And if it's the latter, have you seen any corresponding declines in the food web, in the eco web of upstream and downstream species, you know, birds that eat them or other things that the insects eat?
Thank you. Professor Golson?
Yeah, so it's just biomass. It's the sampling method that was used involved catching literally millions of insects. And the guys that did it in the field are still wading through the samples, counting and identifying and so on. But the one thing you can measure very quickly is the actual, just the total weight of insects. And that's what's fallen. And of course that has really big consequences if you're something that likes to eat flying insects. And we've noticed, for example, that, there's a European species called the spotted flycatcher, which specializes in eating flying insects. In the UK, the populations of the spotted flycatcher are down 95% since 1970. So really, you know, dramatic decline. It was a common bird species when I was a kid, and I haven't seen one for several years now. There was a recent study from the Netherlands which correlated the rates of decline of insect-eating birds with levels of pollution with insecticides in the Netherlands, with the explanation being that they basically found that insect-eating birds are declining faster in places where more insecticides are used, and the implication was not that the birds are being poisoned, but just there's nothing for them to eat. So those links do seem to be appearing exactly as you would expect. If there's no food for things that eat insects, then inevitably their populations are going to decline.
And Professor Golson, a lot of things eat insects. Lynn Dix at the University of East Anglia in the UK was quoted in The Guardian saying that flying insects provide food for so many animals, birds, bats, mammals, fish, reptiles, and amphibians. I mean, this is a lot of animals.
Yeah, I think people just have no idea how integral these things are. I actually did a live radio interview a few days ago with a lady in Australia, and the first question she asked me on air was, well, so insects are disappearing, isn't that a good thing? I didn't really know where to start. I pulled my jaw up off the floor and launched into why are insects so important. I don't know whether she believed me, but unfortunately a lot of people out there, you know, they see insects as just buzzing, stinging, biting nasties, and actually there are billions of them, and they do really important stuff. And also they're really fascinating and amazing, and some of them are utterly beautiful, and it's a shame people don't pay a little bit more attention to these things. But they are an integral part of life on Earth, whether we like them or not.
Whether we like them or not. Well, thank you for that question, Phil. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Professor Williams, let's talk a little bit about this new study that was published in the journal Science. It found that a significant amount of the world's honey contains traces of neonicotinoids. Again, we've been talking about this. It's a class of commonly used pesticides that so many people are using. And the university, a university in Switzerland, Professor Alexandra Ibe and his colleagues gathered 198 honey samples from every continent but Antarctica and looked for signs of neonicotinoids. They found that 75% of honey samples from six continents tested positive for pesticides. What was your reaction when you heard about this study?
Well, I have to admit, I'm not so familiar with the study, but I'm also... This one surprises me somewhat less, I would say. It may be a startling fact, but the way that honey is harvested and the bees that we manage, where they are foraging, would quite likely bring them into contact with a wide variety of different agricultural chemicals, including the neonicotinoid pesticides. So this one I find believable. I suspect it's... Again, as Dave has said, this is not a particularly good thing for the bees. This honey is, of course, their food source, and we know that even at relatively low doses, there can be sublethal effects on those bee species. But these chemicals are now so much a part of our entire ecosystem, and I think spread out beyond the discrete boundaries of agriculture itself, that this is likely to be the case.
Professor Golson, what are your thoughts on this study that looked at pesticides and honey?
I as Neil says, I wasn't overly surprised that samples of honey taken from farmland in Europe or North America were contaminated. I would have predicted they would be. I was slightly surprised and somewhat depressed to see how, you know, even samples taken from remote Pacific islands were contained these neonicotinoids. And I obviously they have farming in those places, and they're using these pesticides, so I guess that explains it. But it does illustrate that these things have become more or less ubiquitous in the environment. And I should add that actually, although the neonicotinoids always get the headlines, there were a bunch of other pesticides in those honey samples as well. And in fact, whenever anyone screens honey for pesticides, they will find a whole range of other insecticides and fungicides and so on. We're exposing our bees to a whole complicated cocktail of chemicals, and we don't understand very well at all how that affects their health. Almost all studies that have been done look at exposing the bees to one chemical at a time, and it's very hard to study the effects of complicated mixtures because there are so many possible mixtures you might look at. If I could just make one final point as well, perhaps quite a controversial one to pick up on, but of course these are honey samples that were for human consumption, and that means that humans are consuming neonicotinoids and a whole cocktail of other chemicals. Admittedly at concentrations which are well below those that will kill you, and below those actually that will produce any measurable effect in the short term, and perhaps in the long term. But the honest truth is nobody can tell you what the effects of a lifetime of exposure to cocktails of pesticides are. And unfortunately, it isn't just honey, of course. There are pesticides in most things we eat these days.
Right.
Which is something that worries me. One intuitive feeling, or mine anyway, is that, you know, I'd rather my food didn't contain a cocktail of pesticides at any concentration, ideally.
Professor Golson, in 2013, the EU began to ban neonicotinoid pesticides. Has that made any difference?
Well, so this is a bit of a complicated story. So, yeah, concern over threats to bees led the European Union to introduce a moratorium in December 2013, which meant that they couldn't be used on flowering crops, which was meant to protect the bees, because that was the main concern, was that if you put them on canola or sunflowers and the bees then visited that crop, they'd get poisoned. But neonics are still really widely used in Europe. They're just not allowed to be used on flowering crops. And in fact, they're being used more than they were before the moratorium. So we have really good figures for the UK. And the moratorium made no dent at all in the rise in use of neonics in UK agriculture. They're just being used on wheat and barley and sugar beet and crops that don't flower, which means they're still going into the environment. And the recent evidence from my own lab and others that shows that, that whatever crop they're applied to, they're leaking into wildflower communities and turning up in bee pollen and nectar anyway, means that actually I would say the European moratorium haven't really been terribly successful. And actually the study we were just talking about, the 75% of honey samples, illustrates that pretty well, because a lot of those samples came from Europe, and the European samples were scarcely lower in the concentrations of neonics than the ones from North America, even though we've got the moratorium. So although Europe has brought this legislation in, it clearly hasn't been effective in protecting bees.
Hmm. And Professor Williams, we've done a lot of shows about the power of the pesticide and chemical industries here in the United States. And the Center for Biological Diversity is suing the EPA. A federal judge last month ruled that the EPA failed to justify withholding more than 140 documents on the harm to protected wildlife from the highly toxic pesticide Enlist Duo, which is a pesticide from Dow Chemical. The Center for Biological Diversity says the case involved the EPA's controversial decision to approve use of Enlist Duo in 16 states, even though the agency found that the pesticide puts dozens of endangered and threatened species at risk. The ruling indicates that the EPA must be much more forthcoming in revealing the science that underpins its decision on pesticides' harm to endangered plants and animals. What are your thoughts on that, and what do you think about how this EPA under Donald Trump is dealing with pesticides and releasing these documents to the public?
Well, I have to say that I'm not aware of the specific details, so I would be widely speculating. In general, I would say that the disclosure and an EPA that is working to increase transparency and the potential threats from pesticides and other environmental toxins that impact the environment and humans is the mandate of the agency, at least partly. So I fully support that. With respect to the particular case, I unfortunately can't really comment on it. I just am not familiar with it. But I wanted to say one other thing about that relates back to the honey samples and why we see pesticides in them and whether agriculture is to blame. And I would just say that one of the interesting things, and I think that might be useful for listeners to recognize, is that agriculture is not the sole source of those. Various chemicals are, of course, applied quite extensively on urban areas and suburban landscapes, and many of the bees that would be providing honey, depending on where they're being kept, could certainly access those as well. So I think we can't only put a finger on agriculture as the sole source of this, not trying to really say that in a positive or negative way, but just to make people aware that there are other sources for exposure, and they're very important, and perhaps something that's more immediate to what many of people that are urban and suburban dwellers in a place like California can also strongly relate to and consider the sorts of things they might be able to do.
That is Neil Williams, professor of pollination and bee biology in the Department of Entomology and Nematology at UC Davis. Dave Golson is professor of biology at the University of Sussex, specializing in the ecology and conservation of bumblebees, and co-author of a new report that has found that the flying insect population in nature reserves across Germany has plummeted by 75% over the past 25 years. And if you have a question or a comment, you can email us your call at kfuo.org. AALW.org. You can also give us a call at 866-798-8255. We have a question from Corey who says, doesn't this mean that people have to repopulate the land, break up factory farms, and start to use organic and sustainable practices? This gets into a question about solutions. Professor Williams, what would you say?
Well, with respect to repopulating the land, I think that's about people moving back onto farmland, or that's an interesting demographic and sociological question, so I think well beyond what I could comment on the likelihood of. I do think that in part, at least a part of my career is focused on the idea of increasing the diversification in what has become a simplified set of agricultural lands in California and beyond. And so this, I agree, is tremendously important. The more that we can do to diversify those habitats and diversify the cropping systems, I think would be a good thing for many, many different insect populations. We've made choices related to the economics of production and perhaps not looked fully at all the downstream costs that come into play when we do that. So I agree that diversifying those landscapes in many different ways is probably a very, very good thing. We're quite far on the pendulum swing towards simplification and intensification, and this is certainly true in California. I would say that many of organizations, both agricultural as well as conservation organizations, are aware of that, and I think value the need to think about things carefully and try to make these changes.
Professor Golson, what changes would you and your colleagues like to see?
I must admit, I very much agree with the listener. I would love to see a move back towards supporting small-scale farms producing food mainly for local consumption. There's pretty good evidence that you need to use fewer pesticides, that you can support more life, more biodiversity, that it's fundamentally more sustainable. You have healthier soil, more carbon capture into the soil, and so on. There are lots of positive attributes to that. Another area that I think kind of relates to this, that would, where there are some easy wins potentially, is to try and reduce waste. You know, we have these huge areas of monoculture crops which do all this environmental damage to produce food ostensibly to feed the human race, and then we throw away more than a third of all that food. It's just insane. So if we were less wasteful. And of course we eat too much meat. I think anyone with even a slight awareness of environmental issues is aware that particularly eating corn-fed beef is not a great move. And eating lots of it is really harmful to the environment. So if we could educate people to just eat a bit less red meat, to not be so wasteful, and try and reduce waste throughout the food supply chain, and try to move towards more sustainable local food production, we could start to address all of these issues.
Professor Golson, I wonder, you are a professor at the University of Sussex, which is in Brighton in the UK. What are your thoughts about what we're facing here in the United States, particularly when it comes to climate change and the issues that you really have dedicated your life to? I mean, we have a climate-denying administration, and the New York Times just reported recently, yesterday actually, that the EPA has canceled the speaking appearance of three agency scientists who were scheduled to discuss climate change at a conference in Rhode Island. But, you know, it's not even just under the Trump administration. A couple of years ago, in 2015, a senior scientist, Jonathan Lundgren, who was a entomologist with the USDA's Agriculture Research Service, spent 11 years with the agency, and he filed a whistleblower complaint accusing the agency of suppressing research findings that could call into question the use of pesticides. So what are your thoughts as someone who lives overseas on what we're dealing with here in the States?
Well, a couple of things. One is that it does seem to me, I don't know California that well, but I've had the chance to visit and in fact visit Neil in his lab. And as I understand it, I think California perhaps faces some of these issues rather more acutely than we do as yet. So, for example, the majority of the world's almonds are grown in California, and they're dependent on a huge number, the best part of 2 million honeybee hives being shipped in from all over the United States to pollinate them. If anything happens to that supply of honeybees, then the almond crop is in big trouble. And, you know, we all know that honeybees aren't doing so well. It's not unimaginable that that honeybee supply might not be adequate in the near future. But probably the bigger issue for you guys, as you well know, is, of course, water. That you're going to face increasing droughts, that the underground water, aquifer water, is being drained, and it may be very hard to sustain current levels of use. And obviously that's absolutely key to successful farming as currently practiced. To comment on the EPA issue, as a general point, and not just actually about the EPA and how they regulate pesticides, but globally, it's worth remembering that when kind of debating neonicotinoids or any other particular insecticide or other pesticide, that if you look back at what's happened in history, we seem to just keep making the same dumb mistakes over and over again. You know, back in the 1940s, we had a ganachlorine insecticide, things like DDT. Turned out they were really nasty, and they ended up eventually all being banned. And then a few years later, the organophosphates were mostly banned, or there's one or two still in use. Now, it's at least in Europe, we're talking about banning neonicotinoids. But at the same time, we're registering new pesticides, which probably in 10 years' time we'll all be looking at and thinking, yeah, okay, they're just as bad too, aren't they? And moving to ban those. But at some point, we have to say, hang on a minute, you know, can't we learn from our mistakes and perhaps try and rein this thing in and not approve pesticides in the first place that are going to do environmental damage? And unfortunately, I don't have great faith in the regulators either in the US or in Europe to do that.
Well, and then the New York Times had another story called Why Has the EPA Shifted on Toxic Chemicals? An Industry Insider Helps Call the Shots. And it's about a chemical, I don't know how to pronounce it, but for short, it's PFOA. It's been linked to kidney cancer, birth defects, immune system disorders, and other serious health problems. The Times reports that scientists and administrators in the EPA's Office of Waters were alarmed in late May when a top Trump administration appointee insisted upon the rewriting of a rule to make it harder to track the health consequences of that chemical. This appointee is Nancy Beck. After she joined the EPA's toxic chemical unit in May as a top deputy, she made that revision. And for the previous 5 years, she was an executive at the American Chemistry Council, the chemical industry's main trade association. Professor Williams, what are your thoughts about this revolving door that we're seeing?
Yeah, well, I have to say I'm completely baffled by what can be possibly going on at the EPA, and I find it disturbing, troubling, and very sad. An agency charged with overseeing the health and welfare of humans is essentially doing less and less. And I think it's true whether we're looking at protection of ecosystem services and pesticides or humans too. I think we need to really wake up and raise our voices that this is not how things should be functioning. So this is tremendously concerning to me, I have to say. So, yeah.
And to bring it back to flying insects and bees dying off, Professor Williams, how is this affecting the agricultural industry in California? I mean, so many people have jobs in that industry. I mean, we've done so many shows about how the die-off of bees really affect everyday life for so many people.
Yeah, I think maybe to bring it back in a sort of interesting socio-political way without going too far that way, in the U.S. we seem to see a rise in the sort of populist feelings, and I think this is an area where we as a community that's informed need to continue to share amongst those different people and recognize the true impacts that they have on our own well-being and livelihood. So it ought to be those worker communities, those agricultural communities that are profoundly concerned and demanding new ways to address this. And I fully agree that a more diversified agricultural system that involves a wide variety of partners that all have a voice at the table will be very important going forward. As Dave said, it's not all about toxins, but in California it's very, very much about water availability, and those industries that rely on it are acutely aware of that issue. We all should be thinking about how changing climate is impacting that. Even if, you know, we should be concerned about it every day, I think.
Professor Williams, what are the other questions you hope to answer in future research?
Well, I think we're looking at a variety of questions related both to the stability of diverse bee communities and also the stability of their populations as they face changes in the availability of food resources and climate change. I think it's important to realize, as Dave Goulson said, this study is about biomass, the European study, but they will get to sorting those insects to understand the different species, and it's species and their attributes that determine the functional role that those species provide in the environment. And so we know it's not debated that there's a relationship between biodiversity and the overall level of functioning, whether it's pollination or pest management or pest control. The diversity of different organisms that contribute to that have a very, very important role to play there. So we will continue to look into that question broadly, and then with population dynamics, really trying to understand the mechanisms by which populations of bees, in our case, a combination of bumblebees and other wild species of bees, how their populations are affected by the availability of food. Those are flower resources for them, and how that intersects with other environmental drivers like toxins, like disease, et cetera. And as Dave again said, studies show that they're not single causes. We need to understand how those interacting factors affect things, and this is tremendously challenging, but we have to face it. We have to do something, and so we will continue to be working on those problems.
And we will continue to focus on this very important issue that deserves far more attention. Neil Williams is professor of pollination and bee biology in the Department of Entomology and Nematology at UC Davis. Dave Goulson is professor of biology at the University of Sussex and co-author of the new report that has found that the flying insect population in nature reserves across Germany has plummeted by 75% over the past 25 years. Professors Williams and Goulson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you so much. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your Calls One Planet series.